rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, American FMs on Live 365, in over 29 million homes in 28 states on CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. It's the last day of the week, time for the first hour of our program, time for our regular segment with Congressman Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. In 1991, Bernie Sanders, became the first independent congressman elected in 40 years to the House of Representatives. Since been reelected seven times, he's the longest-serving independent, not a Democrat, not a Republican, an independent in the history of the House of Representatives. I like to think of him as America's congressman, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Welcome, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. By the way, just to let our listeners know, if you want to drop into our live chat room and participate, TomHartman.com will get you in there. If you want to call the program, if you have comments, questions, remarks, whatever you want to share with Congressman Sanders, our number 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. Bernie, there's the news this last week seems to have been subsumed by, well, I don't want to call it fluff because, you know, there's serious issues, but things that are frankly probably not going to have a great deal of impact on my life or your life, you know, the Terri Schiavo thing, the Michael Jackson thing, while at the same time some really important things have been sliding by. Is that your sense of things?
That sure is, Tom. And, you know, when people hear me ranting and raving about the media, what I'm really talking about is that the problems that tens of millions of Americans face every single day, the collapse of the middle class, the disintegration of our healthcare system, the fact that the jobs available to our young people pay substantially less than used to be the case, the fact that veterans are getting, the Bush administration is making it harder and harder for veterans to get the health care that they were promised, the quality of life for the American people in many ways is in decline. As a nation, we don't focus on those issues because what they end up doing is antagonizing the wealthy and the powerful and large corporations and the people who sponsor radio shows and television shows. But what we do is in many ways deflect attention away from the issues that middle-class Americans need to be debating, need to be discussing. And then we get into issues that really center around the problems of one family or an entertainer. You just think about in the last month, how much ink, how much TV time has gone to the Michael Jackson trial? Frankly, I could care less.
Yeah.
I could care less. I think tens of millions of Americans could care less about Michael Jackson. But it's on TV every night. You got the Scott Peterson case. You got Robert Blake. Well, what do you think, Tom? He was found innocent. That certainly is going to have a huge impact on working families all over America.
Oh, yeah.
Who cares?
And then we've got George Bush running around saying, okay, the Social Security Trust Fund, if you use the 75-year horizon, not the infinite horizon, which projects out 10,000 years, but if you use the 75-year horizon, there's going to be a $4 trillion shortfall. And at the same time, he's pushing to have his tax cuts made permanent, which will produce an $11 trillion shortfall during that same period of time.
Exactly. And how much discussion is devoted to the latter.
I have not seen one story about that this week.
That's right. I mean, and then of course you have, you know, the tragedy of the Schiavo family and all of that. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, let's look at what's really some of the really important issues that are going on. In the last 20 years, we have seen an explosion of technology and worker productivity. The average American worker and worker in the industrialized world is producing a lot more than he or she were producing 20 years ago. Common sense would suggest that the income of ordinary people would be going up. People would be working fewer hours. We have more wealth. But I think as every working person in this country understands, that's certainly not the case. Tom, let me just read from you two stories that tell us almost as much as we need to know about what's going on in the economy
okay.
for the rich and the middle class. Forbes magazine. Forbes magazine had a big article a few weeks ago, And this is the way it begins. The rich had a very good year. The collective net worth of the 691 billionaires we could find is $2.2 trillion, up $300 billion from the combined worth of the 587 people listed last year. In other words, the number of billionaires in the world has gone up rather significantly, and these folks saw an increase in their wealth of approximately 15% over the year. That is for the richest people in the world. Here's another story. This comes from the State of Working America put out by the Economic Policy Institute. Real median family income declined 0.9% per year from 2000 to 2003 in the United States of America, a three-year drop of $1,500 in 2003. In other words, the very richest people in this country and in this world are getting much richer. The middle class is shrinking. Their real incomes are in decline, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Now, what infuriates me is how little discussion there is about that issue in America.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, to flip it around, they're actually getting more brazen about it, Bernie. Yesterday, I was channel surfing after my show, and I went to Kudlow and Company, which is a CNBC TV program.
Right.
And here's this guy, and his tagline, the way that he closed the segment was, he said, you know, I'm Larry Kudlow or whatever, representing the interests, or working to enhance the interests, as I recall he said, of the investor class. And it's like, whoa. It's like, I thought they didn't talk about class warfare. I thought they just accused, you know, people, working people of that.
So these guys are waging class warfare 365 days a year, and they're winning. And this is, their victory is seen just in those articles that I read. And you're seeing not only in the United States, you're seeing it in Europe, you're seeing it in individual countries, not just the United States again. The gap between the rich and the poor grows wider. You're seeing the first world with more and more wealth compared to the developing world. You're seeing fewer and fewer people with just unbelievable amounts of power and wealth.
So,
and just that reality, the fact that in the United States, so few own so much, and that translates not just into money for their families, but into economic power. They're the ones who provide the funds to keep the Republican Party going, and a great number of Democrats as well. They're the ones who own the media, who then tell us what we're supposed to know. And what we're supposed to know is everything we don't want to know about Michael Jackson and Scott Peterson and Robert Blake and the Shriver family. What we do need to know is why it is that our standard of living is a decline, why it is that we can't afford health insurance, why it is that we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, why it is that our environment is deteriorating. Those are some of the things we need to know so we can change that.
Yeah.
Why is not the middle class expanding? Why is not poverty going down rather than going up? Why is not the quality of education improving? Those are the kinds of issues the media should be focusing on.
Well, let's take a shot at answering those questions, Bernie, and talking about what can be done. I mean, from my point of view, it looks like ever since Ronald Reagan came into office and declared war on the working on organized labor and working people, starting with his shutting down PATCO, we've seen a steady deterioration in the purchasing power and the earning power of working people in the United States, right starting almost to the year 1980, right up to today. With the conservative economics, Bill Clinton, the same thing, you know, with NAFTA and GATT and whatnot. I mean, you know, he was sort of a friend of labor, but not really all that much in so many ways. And what do you, when you look at this as an economic sickness, what's your diagnosis, and what should people do? What can people do? What are you doing in Congress, and what can people who you're not their congressman, what can they say to their member of Congress to get things changed?
First thing is we are not going to change the situation unless we have a political revolution, in a sense, in this country, and a change in the political culture. And that means that ordinary people cannot just sit by and allow their jobs to go to China, not be able to see their reality on the television screen, see their healthcare system continue to deteriorate. They have got to get involved. And at the very least, what people have got to do is start meeting with their members of Congress. If they don't like what their members of Congress are saying in response to them, they've got to support candidates who are going to stand up and represent the middle class. Clearly, the political crisis of our time is that the White House and many members of Congress are far more interested in representing the wealthy and the powerful than ordinary people. So the answer to that, to respond to your question, Tom, is that people must be involved in the political process. And it ain't that hard. It really is not.
Yeah.
If you're part of an organization, you can get on the phone, start calling up your member of Congress. The phone numbers are usually 1-800 numbers. They're in the phone book. You can invite him or her to a meeting. Tell them what you think, what you want them to do. Many members of Congress would just prefer that their constituencies would disappear. Many do not. Many enjoy going out and talking to the people. But ordinary people have got to say, hey, Mr. Congressman, we're concerned about A, B, and C. We're watching your votes. These are the issues. So hold elected officials accountable. If you're not happy with what they're doing, be prepared to run candidates against them. That's number one. Number two, I think we have got to develop what I consider to be a progressive agenda. That means an agenda that speaks to the needs of the middle class and working families of our country. What are some of those characteristics? Number one, you mentioned already one of them, Tom, and that is our disastrous trade policy.
Yeah.
An American worker cannot and should not be forced to compete against somebody in China making 30 cents an hour. Our trade policies are a disaster. They've been developed by corporate America, designed to ship millions of decent-paying jobs to China and lower the standard of American workers while the people who own these companies make out like bandits. We have got to, among other things, raise the minimum wage toward a living wage. We have got to guarantee health care to all of our citizens as a right, as an American right, not just a privilege. We have got to take away tax breaks that have been given to the rich and work to end the disgrace of America having the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major countries. So there's a lot to be done.
And let's roll back Tax Harkin.
It won't be done unless ordinary people put the heat on Washington.
Yeah, and let's roll back Taft-Hartley and re-energize labor. Let's give the Labor Department back to labor advocates.
Critically important. If workers do not have unions to stand up and fight for their rights, they're just going to be pushed down and down and down.
And, you know, in fact, I saw just a little clip of some right-winger on a TV show yesterday, and he was talking about how the union-controlled schools in America are failing. And as if the teachers' unions are responsible for the fact that our problem, you know, of our problems in our schools, which, having written several books about this, I can tell you that's not the problem. And,
well, it's always interesting what these guys do, and it's important to understand how they function. They take an issue. Do we have problems with education in America? We sure do. Is it the union's fault? No, it is not. But we'll talk more about that.
Okay, right after the break. I appreciate that. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to be on the air with Congressman Sanders, we will be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
People get ready. There's a train coming.
Well, hopefully that train is the Democrats and the progressives coming down the road to bump the Republicans out of power. Anyway, welcome back. It's Tom Hartman here with you, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, all our phone lines are lit up. We'll get to our calls in just a second. One of the folks in our chat room reminded me of a question. Somebody called in yesterday and asked me to be sure and ask you, and it was something I had been wondering about as well. My recollection is that this last week, when the House and Senate voted on this, shall we call it the Terry Schiavo law, that there were only like three or four people who actually showed up in the Senate, and they passed this thing on a voice vote. Isn't a quorum required? And if so, what is it?
That is a very good question. What I can tell you, I was in Germany, I must tell you, and I just came back. So I missed that. But in the House, you require 50% plus one. You need 218 to have a quorum. But the way that both the House and the Senate often work, Tom, is if there is an agreement for unanimous consent,
right,
you can conduct business with just a handful of people there,
with less
as long as nobody objects. But if somebody were to stand up in the Senate and say, I object, there is not a quorum, then it would be hard to do business. But apparently an agreement had been made beforehand by both parties that nobody would object.
Yeah.
In the House, interestingly enough, there would have been objection, as I understand it. And that's why there was a vote, and there were 218 people who were present. So a lot of business will take place when the two parties agree they want to expedite things, and nobody is objecting.
Even if there's only three people there.
Yeah, you can literally do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding, is that there literally were three senators.
Right. If somebody wanted to pop up and say, I object, there's not a quorum, then there would not be a vote. They could force a roll call vote.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for that point of information. Let's go to the telephone lines. Greg in Florida's on the line. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys, how you doing? Bernie?
Good.
Hey, listen, you know, the coverage of the news just stinks. I don't call it the media because that's a conservative word, but just the news stinks. It's all about fluff, like you said, Schiavo and Michael Jackson. I was wondering what they were going to do after they lost, you know, the big case they lost earlier this week. But what happened to Gore's liberal news that was going to happen during the election? I was hearing all about it. I haven't heard anything since.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, Greg, and thanks for asking it. I mean, I think the good news, and Tom Hartman probably knows more about this than I do, is that what we are beginning to see on radio, which has been dominated for so many years by extreme right-wing talk show hosts, we're beginning to see some of the radio stations around this country who are saying, wait a minute, we have a divided population here. Not everybody is a right-wing extremist. We want other points of view to be heard. And we know that there are an increasing number of radio stations that are now playing progressive radio shows. There is, I think, what's that network? Air America, which is a progressive-type network out there.
Right.
But we're seeing a growth in progressive radio at least. But, Tom, why don't you answer Greg's question as well?
Well, that's the main thing. As far as Gore's TV network, my understanding is that they're still working on it. They've been negotiating to make this thing happen, and time will tell. On the radio side, there is not only Air America Radio, but there are also a lot of independent progressives like my program, and Democracy Radio, which is run by Tom Athens, who's the husband of Senator Debbie Stabenow from Michigan. They put on Ed Schultz and Stephanie Miller and Tony Trupiano in Michigan. I mean, there's some Bernie Ward out in San Francisco, Dave Ross up in Seattle. There's some very talented progressives out there who are really starting to get traction right now. And we've picked up three affiliates in the last 3 weeks. I mean, three different radio stations just in the last 3 weeks. So
to answer Greg's question, and it's a very good question, because we absolutely need a progressive television.
Yeah.
Problem is, it is a very expensive proposition to start a network. Depending on the size, it could run into billions of dollars, and we need it. But our side often cannot attract the kinds of money that the right wing can.
Yeah.
But we are making at least some progress on that issue.
A lot of us were hoping that Ted Turner might jump into the fray, but apparently he doesn't have the means or the energy these days. But time will tell. Anyway, thank you for the call, Greg. Good answer, Bernie. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our number 1-866-889-8894. Here in the No Boring Zone. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program with Congressman Bernie Sanders, the first hour of our last day of the week program. Every week, Congressman Sanders is with us. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number here in our Brunch with Bernie segment. Chris in Florida is on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's up?
I have a cousin who is a disabled American, and she's very concerned about the Terri Schiavo case, and she feels that people are trying to get rid of people who are perceived as undesirable in our society. And do you think that's going to start happening after this Terri Schiavo thing, that today, you know, we start getting rid of people we think are vegetables, and tomorrow might be because they have Down syndrome or something like that.
Okay, thanks very much for that question, Chris. I certainly do not think so. And certainly I and millions and almost everybody in America will do everything we can to make sure that that does not happen. The issue that we're dealing with here has to do with separations of powers. Who makes these decisions ultimately? And clearly they are families within the context of state law. And the objection that many of us had to what happened last week is that for the first time, Congress, in a sense, said, we will take over this issue. We're going to override state law and do away with the separation of powers. And that's a very, very dangerous trend. But to answer your question, Chris, the real issue here, I think, is that throughout this country, families are put into a horrendously difficult situation where in some cases they have people who have been fairly clear about saying or written down in their lives saying, no, they don't want to be kept alive by artificial means. And should they have the right to have their own wishes on it? That's really what the dilemma is about. But Chris, you've raised an important issue, and I want to assure you and your sister that I don't know that anybody in America feels that way. Yeah, that would be a terrible thing.
We're not going back to eugenics. And in fact,
that's exactly right.
Yeah, and in fact, what the court ruled, what the lower courts ruled in Florida was that in addition to the testimony of Terry's husband, she had had when they were married, they had had two family members who had gone into vegetative states that they had to pull a plug on while they were married. And she had made comments not just to her husband but to other independent members of the family and friends who testified in court that Terry had said, if I'm ever like that, pull a plug on me. And so the courts have ruled that, I mean, the basis of all 19 decisions now, the basis of all of them has been, this is what Terry Schiavo would want. And so what's so shocking to me is when you see news reporters that say, Randall Terry is fighting for Terry. For Terry Schiavo, you know, this guy from the Right to Life.
Right.
Well, he's not. He's fighting against her wishes, according to her friends, according to her husband, and according to the courts and the objective data. And this has nothing to do with euthanasia. And,
okay, Chris.
And so yeah, we'll move along from there.
Yeah.
1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up? Tony? No, we lost Tony. Okay, Xavier at Santa Cruz on the line. Hey, Xavier.
Hey, good morning, Tom and Bernie.
How are you?
Hi, good, excellent. I have an idea that a lot of times I think it's important to take the devil's advocate position, not to explore that going in that direction, but just to brainstorm and get new, fresh ideas and think out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of, you know, talking about the disparity in wages between, like, people in China and India and people in the United States, I think part of that is true, that it is true that they get paid a lot less than us. They also have different housing costs and different food costs to take care of part of that. And what I'm finding in the United States is whenever wages get cut, we need to pass those costs on to people like landlords and mortgage rates and things like that. And I think what we're doing here
companies.
Is we're eating it all.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting. I'll bring that issue up, Xavier. Whenever real wages go down, that we should mandate that health care costs go down, rents go down, food prices go down. Unfortunately, you know, as you obviously know, it just doesn't work that way. In fact, one of the concerns is that while health care costs are soaring, many housing costs are soaring, many working people are seeing a decline in their real wages, which makes it very hard for families just to maintain a decent standard of living.
Yeah.
That's John, the issue. But that's a good point, Xavier.
John in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yep, you're just fine. You're live. You're live on the
bad spot.
Yep, no problem.
You there?
Yep.
Okay, great. Two-part question for both of you to answer, one from a media and a congressional standpoint. Congressman Bernie, I'm going back to the rant that you gave at the beginning, at the top of the hour, about all the real issues and the bias toward fluff in the media. As
yes.
a percentage, I mean, how many congressmen do you think feel the same way that you do and would love nothing more than to delve into these real issues? And from that standpoint, do they feel that they have a need, or do they see the need, to actually approach the media with these issues? Go to Lou Dobbs, go to Wolf Blitzer, Joe Scarborough, whoever it may be, and say, why don't you talk about this stuff? This is what really matters in Congress. Turn people's attention toward this. And then, Tom, do you have any inner workings of the media, or like, why doesn't it ever come to that? It seems like an obvious question. Maybe it has an obvious answer. I'll let you answer that.
Okay.
Okay, John, excellent question. And I would answer it by saying that I think many members of Congress, regardless of their political perspective, get enormously frustrated by their inability to communicate through the media with their constituents. Now, you just try to think of somebody says, what's your view on Iraq? You got 7 seconds to tell us. Nobody in the world can do it. So what we end up doing is talking in sound bites, and that's frustrating. We can't express our point of view. The people can't learn or disagree, or we can't have really thoughtful discussions of the issues. In terms of approaching the media, well, in fact, Lou Dobbs, I must say, does a very good job on trade issues. But media is owned by very large media conglomerates. In terms of NBC, it's General Electric. They have their own agenda. And I think it's not just the folks you see on television, but it's the people who own the networks who determine what we're going to see. And for a variety of reasons, they would rather keep America kind of dumb and away from the real issues. Because if we begin to talk about disparity of wealth and income, the decline of our healthcare system, our disastrous trade policy, those are issues that corporate media, the people who own these corporations, support. They're on the other side. They like our trade policy. They are the rich who do not want to talk about the growing gap between the rich and the poor. So I think you have to look at that from a political perspective.
Yeah, and looking at it from a media perspective, I can say when I started in the media back in 1968 and when I was doing news every day in a local radio station in Lansing, Michigan, WITL, this was in the early 70s, throughout the early 70s, this was before the Fairness Doctrine was done away with. There was a policy, and I don't believe it came from law, but at one point it may have been law. I can't honestly speak to that. But there was a policy in place at the networks and at the locals and at the local stations that the news department was not about making money. The news department was about serving the public interest. It was about satisfying the FCC requirement that if you're going to use the public airwaves, you have to serve the public interest. And I know that the radio station that I worked at was losing money. We had 5 people in our news department, and I know that they were losing money on their news, and they were making money on playing country western music all the rest of the day. But they did that because they felt it was a community service. And that, ever since the death of the Fairness Doctrine under Reagan in 78, or 87, I guess it was, that has gone away. And so I think that, you know, we need either a legislative remedy, and I'm not sure that I'm an advocate of the Fairness Doctrine. In fact, I have a lot of problems with it, but I think that we really do need to be saying to the media, and frankly, I think, Bernie, you guys in Congress should be saying it, perhaps through laws that would be enforced by the FCC, that if you're going to use our airwaves, if cable companies are going to use our public rights of way, if satellite companies are going to use outer space, which is part of the commons, then they have to be sure that they are offering news, not infotainment. And that news, if it has bias, at least that bias is clearly identified.
I very much agree with that, Tom. And it's something that we have got to do in Congress, but it's something the American people have got to do.
Yeah.
You can call up your television station and say, I'm tired of hearing about the problems of one individual when there are tens of millions of people who have common problems. We want to address those.
Yeah.
Talk about them.
Yeah, get off Michael Jackson. When was the last time you covered a story about the local nurses trying to unionize or the local Walmart having labor problems? Let's get to the real stuff here. And you can also call your members of Congress, by the way. The telephone
Absolutely.
Number for the switchboard at Congress that will get you in is area code 202. If you want to call the regular line, 202-224-3121, will get you any member of Congress. Or the toll-free number for Congress is 877-SOB-USOB. It really, truly is. Okay, let's get back to the phone lines here. Brian in Grand Rapids, nothing personal, Bernie. Brian in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Bernie. I wanted to ask a question. You had talked about raising the minimum wage earlier. I think what we need to do is create a maximum wage of, say, 100 times whatever you're paying your lowest paid employee.
They do that in a lot of countries in Europe.
That's a very good, very interesting idea. And I think what we have got to do is really expose the incredible greed of people on top. And there are some ways that we can begin to get at that issue, Brian. For example, there has been legislation introduced, which I have signed on to, which says that you cannot deduct as a cost of doing business salaries or compensation packages for people on the top, which are more than X times that of your average worker.
Right.
Right now, one of the scandals of America is that the CEOs of large corporations earn about 500 times more than their average worker, and that is an outrage. So I don't think we have to have a country where everybody makes the same amount, but I think there is something absolutely disgraceful that when we have over 20% of our kids living in poverty, the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world, that these CEOs are making out like bandits. We're seeing a growth of billionaires. I don't think that that is what America was designed to be.
And this is a new phenomenon that's really just come along since the so-called Reagan Revolution and the rise of greed-based conservative economics. Prior to that time, on average, CEOs in America made 30 to 50 times what their employees
did.
In civil service, it's 20 to 1. In most universities,
And there are countries around the world right now where people would be it just doesn't happen. You go to Scandinavia. It just, the culture would not allow it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have got to start raising that issue, and Brian makes a very important point.
Yep, absolutely. Joseph in Las Vegas, Nevada on the line. Hey, Joseph, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, Joseph.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm an African-American male, and as a child, I remember my parents working very hard. They both worked in the post office, and I remember us always having a nice home. And recently, I've been frequenting predominantly African-American sites and their message boards and whatnot. You can leave your messages. And it just amazes me how many African-Americans side with the investment class, as we like to refer to them as. But I left a message on the message board yesterday stating that Georgetown, the hunger strike was over because the students were able to pull it off as far as getting that...
A living wage for the janitors.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a guy on there, conservative, and I don't even think he knows why he's conservative. But his response was, well, yeah, that's great for the working class, but now the tuition is going to have to go up from $44,000 a year to whatever. And I don't think they understand that the amount that tuition would actually have to go up would be negligible.
Yeah,
and how it pertains to
Joseph, I've got to tell you,
raises.
I've got to tell you, I run one of those message boards off TomHartmann.com, and I have firsthand experience with this. There are people, in fact, we have a thread about this on our message board where you can find all the news sources. The right wing, the Heritage Foundation bunch, not that group specifically, but there are a bunch of right wingers who have funded to the tune of millions of dollars private independent folks who are working out of their homes, who go on to liberal and progressive message boards and middle-of-the-road message boards all across the United States, represent themselves as members of those communities, and make right-wing statements.
Wow.
It's a concerted campaign.
Joseph makes a couple of very good points.
Yeah.
Number one, what I find interesting about how the right-wing relates to African-Americans is, despite the fact that the overwhelming, we're talking 85-90% of African-Americans do not vote Republican, so often when you pick up a newspaper, you'll see a right-wing African-American columnist. I think they have them all. You know, anybody who can write who's an African-American suddenly has a column. And you see these guys on TV a whole lot. And there's also clearly a major effort to reach out to the upper class within the African-American community. But I would say, Joseph, the good news is that most African-Americans understand what political struggle is about. They know what they and their families have gone through historically, and they're not going to vote for the rich and the powerful.
Well said. Larry in Kansas on the line. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hey, I just got a few questions and a comment to make. What does the congressman think about when over there in Iraq, when those three countries pull all their troops out, well, who's going to replace those troops? And another thing is, does he think the reservists are getting used too much? And my
good
comment
question
is, I'm refusing to go back to Iraq. My unit's up for deployment here in a few months, and I've already made my point that I'm refusing to go back. I was over there last year, and I refuse to go back because I almost lost my owner-operator. I drive a truck for a living, and I almost lost my truck last time I was over there. Is Congress going to do anything to help us out?
Okay. Thank you, Larry.
Good question.
You've asked two excellent questions.
Yeah. We've got about a minute.
Number one, what we're seeing is more and more countries withdraw. Ukraine, where everybody was excited about the new president there, he's withdrawing his troops. Other countries are withdrawing their troops. The United States is certainly contributing, along with Great Britain, 90-95% of the troops and the money. Serious problem. I think that the reservists and the National Guard have been treated in many ways unfairly, and that's because the Bush administration was not prepared for what happened in Iraq. So, yes, the answer is some of us are trying hard to protect the reservists from losing their income and their civilian jobs.
But it's an uphill battle. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I think it's time for a change, 'cause I'm tired of these games. I'm gonna leave them inside, 'cause I'm all right on the outside.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program with Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie, our regular last day of the week segment, first hour of our three-hour program. And Congressman Sanders, let's go back to the telephone lines. We have Bob in Monroe, Washington, Washington State on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was thinking, I just bought your book, What Would Jefferson Do? Excellent book.
Thank you.
And the other thing, I was listening to Lou Dobbs the other night, and I was thinking about, he was talking about the immigration problem, what Vice President Cheney said. But I was thinking this can all be resolved since our dollar has declined about 30%. When we become, do you think our dollar will ever equal the peso?
Bernie?
Well, that would solve the immigration problem, wouldn't it? Maybe Americans would be going to Mexico looking for work.
Yeah.
I heard, Bernie, heard the Mexican government was very brutal against illegals coming into their country.
From the south, yeah, they are.
Yeah. Guatemala and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the essence of the problem, whether it's so-called free trade with China or the immigration problem, is there is enormous pressure against working people in the United States from people who are earning substantially low wages. And corporate America likes that. They want to see the middle class in this country being forced to compete against desperate people because that drives wages down and makes the rich even richer. And obviously we've got to deal with both the trade policy and the immigration issue.
Okay, let's go to Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Bernie. I was just wondering if somehow the multinational aspect of corporations is keeping them from having to obey antitrust laws. And the next question I had was about basically the cynical use of the media and whether there anything can be done to counteract that. I know when the Jeff Gannon story broke, they brought out the Ward Churchill thing, which actually was 2 years before.
Yeah, we're just about out of time, Logan. I got to hand this off to Bernie and let him answer that. Go for it.
Well, in terms of the multinational aspect of corporate America, many of these companies, whether they're General Electric, IBM, or all of the rest, they no longer see themselves as American companies working for the best interest of the United States. They're international companies, and they're worrying about their international stockholders. And we should keep that in mind when we deal with these guys.
Yeah. I think you were out of the country and you missed it, but there was a great article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago about how GE led the charge into India back in 99 under Jack Welch. Jack Welch's major contribution to America was outsourcing. He just led the charge.
But meanwhile, these guys run to Capitol Hill for billions of dollars in corporate welfare.
Yeah, there you go. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Thanks so much, Bernie. We'll see you next week.
Okay, Tom, take care.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Cover. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our three-hour program. Brought to you by DemocraticMatch.com and Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S. You are here live on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Our live chat room you can get to by going to TomHartman.com. Kyrgyzstan, the government has fallen. This is fairly interesting here. This is a country that, one of the former Soviet states, that had an election a few months ago where the former Soviet toady, the guy who's loyal to Vladimir Putin, got reelected. And the people of the country now are saying that the voting machines were rigged, that the vote was rigged. They're not going to put up with this. And they actually drove out the guy who was in power, Askar Akayev, ran him out of town. This is a country of 5 million people, a relatively small country, although we have a military base there with over 1,000 folks in it. We use it as a staging ground for Afghanistan. This is in the middle of a very strategic region, although the main resources that they have in this country are gold, not oil. The location of the country makes it strategically very, very significant, very important to us. And this is something. This is the third former Soviet republic after the Ukraine and Georgia. And I would toss Serbia, and I would say it's really the fourth, to have flipped as a result of people standing up and saying, these elections are rigged. This electoral process doesn't work. What do you mean politicians running the electoral process? What do you mean Catherine Harris purging people from the voter rolls? What do you mean Ken Blackwell in Ohio being in charge of the campaign plus telling us who we voted for? We're not going to put up with this. In fact, here's what one of the folks... Oh, did I just anthropomorphize that into America? Excuse me. We're talking about Kyrgyzstan. Speaking of the Akayev family, this family has held power, by the way, since 1990. Now, what year was George Herbert Walker Bush? Well, he became vice president in 1980. And many argue that we're going on, let's see, to 12 years of rule by Bush Sr. And so far, 5 years. So we're 17 years now of Bush rule. Anyhow, here's a quote from Ulan Shtambadov, one of the protesters who sat in the president's chair. They took back the parliament building. He says, it's not the opposition that has seized power. It's the people who have taken power. The people! They've been fighting for so long against corruption and against that family. Interesting. When will Americans wake up? Could it be 2006? Could it be now? I find it interesting. There were over 700 demonstrations across the United States last weekend against the war in Iraq. And I didn't see any coverage of it on the network news, yet 300 people show up in Florida to yell and scream about Terry Schiavo, and it is wall-to-wall. What is wrong with our media in this country? Why are we not hearing the straight story? Could it have something to do with huge multinational corporations whose interests align with the plutocrats, the oligarchs of the Bush family and their friends? Could it possibly have something to do with that? Or is it just that the American people really would rather know what's going on with Michael Jackson's trial than what's happening with labor? Why is it that when I was a kid growing up in the 50s and the 60s, we had two big papers in Michigan, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. The Free Press, everybody knew was the, I may be getting them mixed up now, but one of them, I think it was the Free Press, was the business paper, and it had, you know, all the business news. And the Detroit News had all the labor news in it.
And if you and their bias was pretty clear. Most towns had multiple newspapers, and you knew where they stood. And now you've got these huge combines that have just sucked up all the newspapers so that you have, you know, one newspaper town, major cities. When we used to live in Atlanta, the Atlanta Constitution Journal, they didn't have any competition. Major cities, one newspaper. And so that newspaper says, okay, well, we're providing you with unbiased news. We no longer have a bias, or if we do, it's only on the editorial pages. But what happened to the labor news? 97% of the people in America are drawing of the working people in America are drawing a paycheck as a salary. They're part of the working class. Their primary income is not from investments. They're not part of the investor class or the CEO class. 97%. And yet, where is the page in the newspaper that talks about the unionization efforts here, the cost of living there, what labor is doing here, how this is going to impact working people? It's gone. You could find out about the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Now, how many people is that meaningful to on a day-to-day basis? Yes, a lot of working people have some money in 401ks or whatnot. They're not watching that from day to day. It's like, you know, we've entered an Alice in Wonderland world. Let me just, it's Friday. I just want to hop around a little bit. Here's the reason, this is from today's Wall Street Journal. This is the reason why, if Jim Jeffords is right, Jim Jeffords, you will recall, we played the tape of it yesterday. Jim Jeffords came out and said, lifelong Republican, United States Senator, left the Republican Party in 2001, is now an independent, but lifelong Republican Jim Jeffords, the only Republican that I've ever voted for in my recollection, and I did vote for him in the year 2000, when he was still a Republican. And Jim Jeffords came out and said, clearly and unambiguously, that he believed that Bush went to war in Iraq for two reasons. Number one, oil and oil money for his friends in the oil industry. And number two, so that he could be a war president and get himself reelected in 2004. And Jim Jeffords then went on to predict that in 2006, just before the 2006 election, Bush would get us into another war. And he speculated it might be Iran. Well, I don't think it'll be Iran, and here's why. I think it'll be Syria, frankly, if you want a prediction. Or, you know, instability might happen somewhere else. We'll see. He'll figure out something. But here's this from today's Wall Street Journal article by John Larn and Jay Solomon. Rapidly growing trade and security ties between India, which is the new darling of American corporations. GE led the charge in 1999 under Jack Welch into India, outsourced to India. Between India and Iran are posing a fresh challenge to the Bush administration as it seeks to curtail Tehran's nuclear ambitions. New Delhi, of course the capital of India, eager to take advantage of Iran's massive natural gas fields to meet its spiraling energy needs, is pursuing broad trade and security relationships with Tehran that could undermine attempts by Washington to isolate the Middle Eastern country. Indian leaders view Tehran as a stabilizing force in Central and South Asia. Larkin and Solomon go on to point out New Delhi and Tehran are also jointly developing ports, rail links, and road links connecting Iran's coast to Afghanistan and Central Asian states. And then they go on to talk about how Iran is also developing this kind of a relationship with China. They quoted Brahma Chalani, a strategic analyst in New Delhi, who advises the Indian government on security issues. He says, Iran is the most important supplier of oil and gas to India. We do not want to isolate Iran. Condi Rice was in New Delhi last week, you will recall, and she brought up the topic of India's getting into bed with Iran. Our, quote, concerns, end quote. Indian Foreign Minister Natwar Singh responded that New Delhi has no problems with Tehran. In other words, Condi, mind your own business. Mind your own P's and Q's. Get out, you know, this is not. Iran is home, the Wall Street Journal notes, Iran is home to the world's largest natural gas field and the world's fifth largest oil reserves. This January, four Indian energy companies signed a $40 billion deal with Tehran to import liquefied natural gas and to help develop three Iranian oil fields. You know, if we'd simply said to Saddam, hey, we'll just buy your oil from you. And he tried to sell it to us at the last minute. Remember, he says, okay, I'm not going to denominate it in euros. I'm not going to do that. I'll sell it to you cheap. Come on in. No. Wolfowitz had his vision of a free trade zone in the Middle East, of a libertarian Iraq, where there would be no trade barriers whatsoever. They would do away with all tariffs. Multinational corporations could come in. They could completely expatriate their profits. They could take all their profits out of the country. They could strip mine the country. And that's how we rewrote the Constitution under Paul Bremer. And, you know, the Iranian, I'm telling you, the Iraqis, once they get control of their country back, the first thing they're going to do is roll back the insanity that Paul Wolfowitz inflicted upon them and Bremer. 17 minutes after the hour, number 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Rick in Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, happy Good Friday to you, Tom.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, and happy Easter.
And regarding the two Detroit papers, I don't know if that was different in the old days, but as far back as I can remember, the Free Press was the more liberal paper, and the News was the...
Yeah, so I had it backwards.
Probably.
Thank you.
But what I want to talk about, I don't know if you stayed up late enough to watch Nightline last night.
I did not.
Well, they were talking about Tom DeLay, who used to be known as Hot Tub Tommy, and now he's known as the Hammer.
Hot Tub Tommy?
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't. Tell me about this.
Well, believe it or not, I first found that out from Lyndon LaRouche. I check his website periodically, you know, and I'm in contact with some of those folks. I don't belong to the group.
Yeah, well, that's good to know.
Kind of a fellow traveler, you might say.
Okay.
But anyway,
all right.
Well, the deal is Tom DeLay, when he was down in Texas, and even when he first came to Washington, he... This is kind of off the topic, but I mean, since you asked, he was quite a party animal. You know, he went to a lot of lobbyist parties where there was a lot of good food, wine,
and good times. And thus Hot Tub Tommy.
Yeah, well, he actually would get in the hot tub. I don't know if he was in there alone or with other men or women or what the deal was.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, he got a conversion, you know. And I wish he still was Hot Tub Tommy. He was probably more of a fun guy back then.
Well, apparently, I mean, this $25,000 trip to London, you know, paid for by lobbyists, apparently he still is. But anyhow, we've got about a half a minute here, Rick. What was the
point? Okay, well, basically, I just wanted to know, and since you didn't see it, it might be hard for me to answer this, but the fact that Nightline did this story and they had Lou DeBose on, I think the fellow you had on as a guest some time back that wrote the book called The Hammer on him?
He wasn't on my program, but I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Oh, I thought he was. Anyway, I just wondered if you think that since ABC has decided to do a story on this, and he's getting a lot of things piling up against him as far as ethical allegations, and maybe losing a little bit of favor with his own party, do you think his days are numbered?
It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. He, you know, Newt, when he was in this situation and was caught taking huge, essentially bribes from big corporations, just backed out. DeLay instead has rewritten the rules and changed the ethics committee. Whether he can hang on or not, time will tell. I honestly don't know, Rick. Thanks for the call. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, at least not if you're watching faux news. Stay away from the neurotoxin. Fox News, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, and Alice in Humboldt County. Happy Easter to you, Alice.
Hello, Tom.
If appropriate.
I listen to the news every day, Tom, and I never hear much of what I hear on your program. Nowhere do they talk about the election fraud.
Yeah, I've noticed that. It's a tragedy.
Yes, it is. It is a tragedy. 91 years, I've never heard anything about it.
Now, when you were younger, Alice,
mm-hmm.
I mean, your institutional memory, your memory of this nation certainly exceeds mine by about 40 years. When you were younger, and there was a lot of election fraud going on in the United States in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, certainly particularly down south where blacks were disenfranchised. Was it discussed in the media?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I lived in North Dakota and on the West Coast, and I guess we weren't aware of it. You know, we didn't have TV and things like that in the beginning.
Yeah. So and it wasn't a local issue there, so your local media would not have covered it. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that it was one of those kind of things that I know certainly in the early 60s down south before it got exposed by the Kennedys and by Martin Luther King and whatnot, that it was just sort of everybody, you know, kind of wink nod, you know, went along with, or mm-hmm. at least all the white folks did, you know. And I just don't think that this level of election fraud that's going on right now, that's so blatant. I mean, Catherine Harris taking 90,000, somewhere between 70 and 90,000 African-Americans, mostly African-Americans, and removing them from the voting rolls before the Bush versus Gore election in heavily Democratic areas. I mean, that was the thing, to the extent that you could claim or that they can claim that Bush won Florida. It was because she did that. Now she's getting all this political payback. She's talking about running for the Senate. The Republicans are trying to, you know, Karl Rove yesterday in the news, they were talking about how Karl Rove talks with her several times a week. I think it's because he's trying to say to her, keep a low profile, you know, because she's the poster child for election fraud. And she thinks she's quite proud of herself. She delivered for her party, you know. And mm-hmm. and it's and Ken Blackwell now in Ohio, he did the same thing. Or he did actually, you know, he delivered Ohio to the Republicans in highly dubious ways. And now he wants to run for governor. And I have a feeling that he's got a big surprise coming, just like Catherine Harris did. Although maybe not. I mean, she got a seat in the United States House of Representatives out of the deal. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how corrupt things are, Alice.
I know it.
It's just
and what I worry about is the next election.
Yeah, 2006. And now in your state of California, I understand that Arnold Schwarzenegger, now that Kevin, I'm forgetting his last name, but your Secretary of State has stepped down, who was the guy who stopped the electronic voting machines, that Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to replace him with a guy who has close ties to the voting machine companies and to the old Republican machine out there. So you can expect to see rigged voting machines coming to California by 2006. From what I'm reading.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I will have more news about this next week because it's just starting to come out right now, and I didn't want to report on it until I have all the details. But
I'm glad you're working on it.
Oh, I am.
We need somebody to work on it.
I am, and I'm glad you're listening, Alice, and I'm glad you're spreading the word with your friends.
Keep
passing it along, and thanks for the call, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. The scientists have discovered Tyrannosaurus rex tissue. Did you get this? This is just one of those kind of interesting things. 70 million years old, or if you're a creation scientist, 5,200 years old. And they actually found soft tissue in it. Will they be able to clone a Tyrannosaurus rex? Boy, wouldn't that be fascinating? 29 minutes past the hour, and would he recognize Tom DeLay as a direct relative? The True People's Radio.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour. Our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Let's just get a few phone calls out of the way here before we move on to our Best of the Rest of the News segment. Kate in Humboldt County on the line. Not to sound like I'm like doing housekeeping here, but...
All right, Tom.
Hey, Kate. What's up?
Hi. Well, I wanted to... I've called in several times just talking about the unintended good consequences of Bush's election. And it keeps being more and more clear to me that... because he was elected and they're more and more blatant in their outrageous behavior, it makes the it clears up the picture more about how we want to clarify what we're seeking, what we want, look back to our roots, to define ourselves, redefine ourselves.
I absolutely agree with you, Kate. Absolutely.
And I think that one of the things that you've made me become very aware of is language. And I just wanted to make one point. I've been wanting to bring this up for weeks, and I'm finally calling you about it. And that is that we often slip into the habit of using the words the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the government actually really is us, and we shouldn't vilify it by just generally calling any administration the government.
Right.
I think we should begin to really be careful about saying the Bush administration, not the government.
Yeah, or the Bush administration and our government. Kate, thanks. Good point.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, or Republican-controlled Washington.
Hey,
last night I picked up your book, What Would Jefferson Do? I've already gotten through the first 25 pages, and, man, you're hard-hitting. You cut right through the haze. Love it. And I actually, at the cashier, I told the guy, this is one of my pills to escape the matrix. he looks at me, I just said, just read it, you'll know what I mean.
Yeah.
But the reason I wanted to call real quick, I know there's not much time here, but again, framing language and how they've hijacked the term democracy and corrupted it, you know, to mean crony capitalism. And yesterday on your Ayn Rand guest and how you said how he's intellectually honest and how the conservative movement has been colored by the objectivist movement. And so they won't admit that they really don't believe in democracy, that really what they're talking about is capitalism.
Right.
And we have to redefine the term democracy to me, what it really means, power to the people.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And my point was that the Ayn Rand folks at least will come right up front and say that, whereas most so-called conservatives won't.
We can start by democracy in the workplace.
Right, which is another phrase for unionization.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. We have every Friday we try to have, you know, an overview of the news here with folks who are out there producing the news, involved with the news. Doug Cunningham is a reporter anchor with the National Workers Independent News Service. Or Workers Independent News, rather, and whose programs you hear at the top and bottom of this hour and have for well over a year, as I recall, produces a daily WIN news story on the Air America Radio Network and for KMOX in St. Louis. Hey, Doug, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be on with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. I'm wondering what you're at Workers Independent News at WIN, what you are seeing or what you have seen as the biggest news story of this past week.
Well, you know, the healthcare crisis for working Americans is a big issue that Workers Independent News covers on an ongoing basis. And this past week, I think we saw an important development with United Auto Workers for the first time agreeing to roll back some of its excellent healthcare benefits at Chrysler. And then, predictably, you saw a couple of days later, General Motors then calling for the UAW to give up some healthcare concessions to it as well. And this is important for a couple of reasons. The UAW has long had the best health care plan and benefits for blue-collar workers in the country. And the health care crisis, as you know, and as you've talked about on your program before, is hitting workers everywhere in this country. And when a union like the UAW, who has such excellent health care benefits, is giving up some concessions to the automakers, that is, I think, an important story for workers.
Yeah, and the consequences are substantial. I mean, this
oh, they're huge. And for decades, as I mentioned, UAW has had the best health care going on for blue-collar workers anywhere in the country. And General Motors says it's in serious financial trouble. GM covers, by the way, 1.1 million workers under its health care plans at a cost of roughly $5 billion a year. And the UAW and GM are headed for talks next month, and health care will be on the table as they discuss that. And so we'll be watching developments there very closely to see what the UAW does, to see what GM demands, and to see what that means for workers.
Yeah, and let's just be very clear, Doug Cunningham. This is not the UAW's fault, in quotes, as, like, you know, the union has decided to roll over and become wusses. And this is really not even General Motors' fault, in quotes, in that they are evil, nasty SOBs. This is the predictable result of a change in our international trade policies that, you know, arguably was promoted by General Motors, so they're getting the benefit that they work for, but nonetheless was put through and approved by people that we elected. I mean, this is the consequence of trade policies that go back to Reagan and then and Bush, and some of them go back even before that. You could argue that a lot of this goes back to Taft-Hartley in 1947 when over the veto of Harry Truman, of Democratic President Harry Truman, the Republican Senate, the Republican House passed the Taft-Hartley legislation that allowed an apartheid within the United States to establish itself. That's the wrong word, but allowed outsourcing within the United States. That is some southern states that decided to become so-called quote right to work states started competing with the northern unionized states, and it was this temporary boom for the South. But what happened was that over a long period of time, the overall standard of living in America dropped, and then they started dropping our trade barriers all around the world, and boom, combined with, again, we could argue, short-sighted policies on the part of some of these automakers. We certainly saw this in the late 70s. I think we're seeing it again right now. Why is it that I can go in and buy a GM car right now off the lot, but if I want a Toyota Prius, I have to wait 6 months? Doesn't that tell us something about what demand is in the marketplace? And yet,
and General Motors is struggling with market share, of course, but the larger healthcare crisis that's going on here is it's getting unsustainable for both workers and for companies to pay for healthcare given the current healthcare system that exists, and we see no evidence of any kind of Bush administration initiative to address that urgent crisis in the form of universal healthcare plan or anything else that would actually really address that. So you're going to have workers fighting it out with companies over it.
Yeah, exactly. And that really brings us to a whole third area, and that is setting aside the issue of the declining strength of American manufacturers or the challenges that the labor union labor movement is facing in the United States. And that's the whole point, that for many, many years in the United States, for most of our history in the United States, we said, if you want to be in the business of providing health care or health care insurance, you want to be a healthcare insurance company like Blue Cross Blue Shield, you want to run a hospital, you have to be organized in such a way that the first thing that you do is provide that service to human beings. Because this is life and death stuff. This is not making shoes. This is life and death stuff. And
absolutely.
So you have to be a nonprofit corporation. And hospitals had to be nonprofit corporations in every state in the union. Health insurance companies had to be nonprofit corporations in every state in the union. And again, starting with Reagan, we had this movement away from that. And this is how Bill Frist's family became worth hundreds of millions of dollars, buying up county hospitals, formerly not-for-profit hospitals, turning them for profit, getting squeezing the labor force down as to the lowest wage they can possibly get, cutting services and making more and more profit. And now we have a healthcare system that has gone from being not for profit and doing a reasonably okay job of actually delivering healthcare services in the United States 30 years ago to being for profit and doing what for profit corporations are supposed to do, doing a spectacular job of generating corporate profits. But in the process, everybody's getting screwed. Our health is at risk. Our labor force is at risk. Our companies that are funding health care are facing problems. I mean,
and this issue too for labor unions and for working families, this means too that when they negotiate their deals with companies that are unionized, the tremendous cost of health care is robbing whatever wage increases might otherwise be available. So that's another aspect of it, that it's affecting working families in a big time way throughout the country.
Right. And then we get into the fourth dimension of it, as it were, which is that the social contract that we've had in the United States, certainly since since Roosevelt's time, Franklin Roosevelt's time, but Teddy Roosevelt talked about this a lot, although he wasn't successful in doing anything about it. But Franklin Roosevelt actually did something about it. The social contract that we've had, by and large, up until this point, has been that our employers make sure that their employees either have a high enough wage that they can afford to care for their sick, for sickness, provide themselves with health insurance and whatnot, or the employer is providing the insurance itself. And now we have, again, since Reagan, since we've had this rise in conservative economics, this idea that, hey, you're on your own, buddy, that now increasingly Americans are no longer insured by their employers. We have, big employees. Walmart has replaced General Motors as the largest employer in the United States. They're not unionized. The insurance that they offer is, I would, respectfully say, a joke. And
so
now we have all these workers in America who can no longer turn to their employers for insurance. And at the same time, you have conservatives who set this situation up. You have conservatives in Congress and the White House, the House and Senate, saying, not our problem, not our problem.
And it's just absolutely incredible because the working class and middle class, which is really what you're talking about these days when you talk about a working class in America, is under assault on so many different levels. I mean, the health care, the jobs that are being outsourced, the pensions, private pensions are also under assault, the Social Security privatization. It's one of the most intense periods for working families in modern American history. As labor unions attempt to fight back, they're doing so with a deck of cards that's stacked against them in terms of labor law and the Bush National Labor Relations Board, et cetera. So all of these issues are sort of interrelated, interconnected, and they add up to a big problem, a big challenge for working families in this country. And that's what we try to do each day with Workers Independent News, is that we try to get the workers' voice out there on the air and cover these issues from that perspective.
Yeah, and you do a great job of it. We're talking with Doug Cunningham of Workers Independent News. Your website is?
LaborRadio.org.
LaborRadio.org. And let's just take a quick call here. We have Yash in Valley College, New York on the line. Hey, Yash, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I'm actually calling about nothing related to what you guys are talking about.
Well, in that case, I'm going to ask you to call back later, Yash. I want to finish up this conversation. I appreciate your call, though. Talking with Doug Cunningham, anchor reporter, Workers Independent News. It produces a daily win news story for Air America Radio Network and for KMOX in St. Louis and for the Tom Hartman Program. And, Doug, one of the stories, seemed to me one of the big stories of the week, was this whole thing of the students in Washington, D.C. Tell us about this.
Absolutely. The Georgetown University students who went on a hunger strike there starting on March 15th, and their goal was to get a living wage for janitors who were employed as contract employees at Georgetown University. Some of those janitors were paid as little as $8.50 an hour.
These are people working full-time trying to raise families on this. This wasn't just, you know, hey, here's a little part-time job sort of thing. We're talking, anyhow, continue.
Well, yeah, and the students had tried to negotiate with the university, had attempted to get these wages increased, and they kept running into stalling tactics. They kept running into no action. Several committees would meet, and nothing really would happen, and no real urgency from the students' point of view. So the students decided to do a hunger strike, 25 of them. They launched the hunger strike. They drew support from labor leaders, both nationally and in the Washington, D.C. area, also from clergy people in the Washington, D.C. area. Got some media attention, and they were able, on Thursday, they were successful in getting an increase in these wages, although not exactly what they had wanted to get, not fully what they had wanted to get. They were successful in getting the university to move on this issue, and I think it's pretty remarkable when students like that will put themselves on the line, you know, for workers. It's a good sign that the labor union movement and the folks that have solidarity with workers, that it's not dead in this country yet.
You know, it seems to me like not only is it not dead, but that it's like the pendulum is swinging back, or the cycle is coming around, or whatever metaphor you want to use, that we're almost back to the era of the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s. Karl Rove has said that he wanted to model the Bush administration after the McKinley administration, of course, which was the late 1890s. And labor,
he's pretty much on target.
Yeah, and he's doing it. And that was the time. Joe Hill was before that. He was the 1860s, 1870s, wasn't he? I don't recall. That's my recollection. That was the time when labor was really starting to come into its own. I mean, during the time of Abraham Lincoln, they still put the word strike in quotation marks in newspaper headlines. It was a brand new thing. Lincoln being the first president to actually speak out on behalf of labor and restrain local police from going in and killing people who were trying to organize. Although he wasn't fully successful in many cases, and it wasn't a huge cause for him, but he was the first person to speak up for it. But it seems to me that there's this new actual consciousness, a new awakening. It's almost like a generation forgot, and people are rediscovering. Not like there's been like this continuity, but it's almost a rediscovery of the fact that we need to have, you know, if we're going to say democracy's on the march, democracy around the world, we're in favor of democracy, what about democracy in the workplace? That's where you spend half your waking life, and democracy in the workplace is otherwise known as organized labor.
Yeah, and what happens in the workplace obviously is vital to what happens to working families, and the power relationships that exist there. That's really important to the standard of living that American families are going to be enjoying, or the standard of living that they're going to see eroded depending on the outcome of this battle. So while they're under attack, working families and labor, one of the good things about being under attack is it rallies people to your side and wakes people up and gets people moving again. And so we might be able to, we may be poised for a labor resurgence. I mean, there's talk of reform within the AFL-CIO. That's very exciting and very dynamic. And there are lots of things underway with the fight against Social Security privatization that the labor union movement is spearheading, along with AARP and others. So we're not seeing people just roll over and play dead here, even though they're under intense attack. They are rallying, they are organizing, and they are carrying the struggle forward.
And it's a good thing.
Good news.
It's a great thing. We've been talking with Doug Cunningham, reporter anchor for the Worker Independent News, laborradio.org, their website. Doug, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I do appreciate it. Keep up the great work. We truly appreciate it here. 10 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
President's budget will shift at least $60 billion in Medicaid costs to the states over 10 years. The level of cuts will almost certainly push hard-pressed states to eliminate coverage for a substantial number of low-income people, increasing the number of uninsured and underinsured Americans. George Bush will be cutting education. Almost one-third of the domestic programs the president targeted for cuts are in education, with funding reductions totaling $1.3 billion. Deep cuts in federal grants will squeeze states and localities. Grants to state and local government for all programs other than Medicaid would decline by $10.7 billion, or 4.5% after adjusting for inflation. By 2010, the cuts will be much bigger. The president's budget calls for drastic cuts. This, by the way, this information from AFSCME, the AFSCME.org, the American Federation of... I'm drawing a blank. I wish they would have it right here on their board. Food and service workers, isn't it? I think so. I'm pretty sure. Memorize your unions before you start speaking of them. There you go. Deep cuts in federal grants will squeeze states. Look out. The president's budget cuts call for drastic cuts in many federal programs and services, which will harm millions of children, seniors, and working adults. Defense, foreign aid, and homeland security funding are all increased, while other domestic spending is drastically reduced. Given indexed inflation, expected inflation, this would mean a cut in real terms of 14% by 2010. The budget also reduces or eliminates 150 programs, block granting and slashing vital public services for a wide variety of needs. Veterans health care, community development programs, social services, job training, law enforcement, housing, social services, election reform, assistance to the states, child care. At the same time, the Bush budget will provide for huge and permanent tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and will provide for people who earn their living by sitting around the pool on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail to pay only a maximum income tax rate of 15% with no Social Security payments whatsoever. Ain't it wonderful? And what do we get on the news? We get Michael Jackson. We get Terry Schiavo. We get... It's time to wake up, America. Look at what they are doing to our nation. Look at what they are doing to the fabric of our country. and get active. Let's do something about this. This is Tom Hartman, the radio home of democracy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. You are in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live on stations from coast to coast. You were speaking partly about the troubles that free trade agreements create, writes Michael in Hasuda, Japan, listening to our program on the web stream, on one of our web streams. I'm not sure if he's listening to RadioPower.org or White Rose Society or American FM, but one of them, he doesn't say. But to the best of my knowledge, we don't have an affiliate in Japan, and the Sirius satellite doesn't reach that far, so it's got to be on the web. Anyhow, he says, as always, I enjoyed your show today. You were speaking partly about the troubles the free trade agreements, NAFTA, CAFTA, and the EU, create for citizens while enriching multinational corporations. Let me just recap that very quickly. This is a point I don't think it can be made enough. I think we need to understand this. Americans must come to understand this. People around the world, it's slowly dawning on some. In other nations, it's conventional wisdom. It's well known. When I was young in the 50s and 60s, and even the 70s, I suppose, even today, but back then in particular, there were a lot of folks, this is, you know, during the Cold War, who were scared to death that there was a one-world government coming. Nikita Khrushchev had famously said, "We will bury you." His comments have been taken out of context, of course. He was speaking economically. He was talking to Richard Nixon at the International World Trade Fair or whatever it was. It was in New York, and he said, "We will bury you." And what he meant was that the Russian economic engine, the Soviet economic engine, was going to be so marvelous that it would just wipe us out economically. And frankly, I think if the conservatives had quoted him in context, it would have been equally ridiculous. I mean, it would have made the Soviet Union look equally silly. In fact, they could have pulled out the numbers about how the Soviet economy had been doing since the overthrow of the Tsar, basically. And it would have demonstrated the lie of the totalitarian regime that Khrushchev was leading at that time. But in any case, what they did was they said, oh, he says he's going to conquest militarily, and therefore we have to have more nuclear missiles, and you know, the feeding frenzy was on. That's what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, in fact. The consolidation of power among the military-industrial complex. But not to digress too far, the point is that there was this incredible fear during that time, that this one-world government would appear, that the Soviet Union, because they had, ever since Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto back in the 19th century, ever since then, the communists had been saying that it would become a worldwide movement, that the whole world would be swept with communism, blah de blah de blah. And they were saying that. And the ideologues really did believe that. From Trotsky to Che Guevara. I mean, they really believed that. Or hoped for that, whatever. That was their rhetoric. There were a lot of people in the United States, not a communist country, a country that where we believe in capitalism and free enterprise, who were saying, with some legitimate concern, these guys are out to get us. And they were afraid that the instrument that would be used to come and get us would be a takeover of our government by virtue of the treaties provision in our Constitution through the United Nations. Now, the way that the Constitution of the United States is written, it essentially says that if we enter into a treaty with another government, with another country, then that treaty becomes the law of the land. It supersedes state and federal law, and that treaty then, you know, boom, guess what? You've got a new law, and it's based on the treaty. And so if we were to sign a treaty with, for example, the UN, that gave the UN certain powers, then they could use those powers to override, you know, overwrite laws passed by the United States, even things within the Constitution. You know, if we signed a treaty with Canada that said, in exchange for pulpwood from Canada, we will end free speech in America, that would become the law in America. Now, you know, you could argue that would probably get struck down, but you could argue also that it might not. And that was the fear back then, was that the UN, because the communist countries had a seat at the table, the Soviet Union on the Security Council, China on the Security Council. There were many communist countries who were members of the UN. I remember in 1964 reading, at the ripe old age of 13, reading John Stormer's book, None Dare Call It Treason, in which he talked about how the communists had infiltrated the State Department and the United States government, and they were going to use the United Nations, among other things, to turn the United States into a communist government. And I was alarmed about it. I was so concerned about it that I spent months going door to door for Barry Goldwater in 1964. And it was really interesting to me to go back and read Goldwater's final autobiography. He wrote two autobiographies, one called Conscience of a Conservative, which is a brilliant book, and the other, his final autobiography called No Regrets. They're both brilliant, frankly, I have to say. Goldwater is generally criticized for two things. One, that he was so in favor of military spending, and the other, that he was opposed to the civil rights movement. And they're both legitimate criticisms. His opposition to the civil rights movement came out of his fear that the civil rights movement had been infiltrated by communists. He was not. I am convinced he was not a racist. And his pushing for military spending was out of his fear that the communists were coming to get us. And reading No Apologies, it was really a tragic read. Because here's a guy who, particularly in his later years, when he was very outspoken and said, you know, the government has no business in our bedrooms. The government has no business regulating what substances we take in private. If you're high driving on the street, that should be a crime. But what you do in your own home, the government has no business in that, regardless of what it is. And the government should not be deficit spending. We should pay our bills. And he did believe that there should be a certain level of social safety net, although he thought that Roosevelt had gone too far. And that's one of the areas where I depart from Barry Goldwater now. I didn't 30 years ago, but in any case, or 40, however long ago it was, nearly 40 years ago. I'm dating myself here. But in any case, he was so concerned that this one world government was going to come and get us. And I'm using Goldwater really as a metaphor for so many of the conservatives back then, and frankly, for many of the liberals and the Democrats back then. LBJ was afraid of the communists. I mean, there's just a pervasive fear of communism. The whole domino theory in Vietnam. And at the same time, the CIA was saying to us, and we now, you know, a lot of the stuff is declassified now, and we know, you know, it's not a secret anymore. We know that as early as the early 1960s, as early as the Kennedy administration, the CIA was saying that the Soviet Union had less than 20 years to survive. Now, it turned out they had 27 years from the Kennedy administration, more or less. But the CIA called it right. They said that economic system will not survive. It is crumbling from within, and it'll collapse. And it did. It had nothing to do with Reagan outspending them on military weaponry. That you know, to some extent that might have sped it up by a few months or a year or two. But the reality is that we had known for a long, long time the Soviet Union was going down. It was unsustainable. So where I'm going with this is that we had this horrible fear of this one world government that conservatives in the United States, by and large, were afraid was going to take the form of the United Nations and impose communism on us, impose an economic system on us that would work against our best interests. And now, today, we have a one world government by virtue of treaty, using the treaty's provision of the United States Constitution, imposing its will upon us and forcing us to change laws in the United States passed by we the people to protect ourselves. The one world government is here. The conservatives were right. They just had the wrong group. It's not the United Nations that's doing it. It's the World Trade Organization. It is NAFTA, Article 13 of NAFTA. It is these multilateral trade agreements, and if we get into CAFTA, it's going to be the same thing. And the European Union is beginning to discover this. The EU countries, we saw just last week, or perhaps it was early this week, Germany and France said, we're not going to participate in any more of these opening the boundaries things with regard to services. We did that with regard to manufacturing, and it has led to stagflation in our economy. They're seeing in the developed countries of Europe, they are seeing the same problems that we are having here in the United States and the other developed countries of the world are having as a consequence of this so-called free trade. And what it is it's a surrender of sovereignty. We are giving our sovereignty to an unelected, undemocratic institution that represents the interests of a very small number of very wealthy and powerful people who have no interest in democracy. I mean, you know, they might be good people. They may even personally think democracy is a fine idea. But what they're all about is making money. And as I've said many times in this program, I have no problem with that. I've made a lot of money in my life, and I salute people who make money. However, when groups whose first purpose is making money start involving themselves in governance, in making laws, you no longer have democracy. You then have oligarchy, you have autocracy, you have plutocracy. I mean, there's a lot of different words. You have feudalism. Mussolini most recently invented this in the 1930s, the late 1920s in Europe, in Italy, when he replaced the parliament with the Camio del Fascio Corporationes, or however you say it, the parliament of the fascist corporations, so that people were no longer represented by their elected officials. They were represented by the largest corporations in their districts. Now, oddly, we're almost there in the United States. You look at whose tune is Tom DeLay dancing to? And this is not limited, by the way, to Republicans. And we have this situation. And the consequence of this is that multinational corporations are getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and more powerful, and we, the people in the middle class of America, are being wiped out. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here's a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The state of Massachusetts and 30 other local governments in the United States had passed laws that banned imports of products that were manufactured with slave or child labor from repressive dictatorship dictatorships such as Burma. Facing a World Trade Organization challenge, the Supreme Court struck down these laws, which have been passed by the people of 30 states, making now illegal the kind of boycott that led to the freedom of Nelson Mandela and the end of apartheid in South Africa. Laws in England and France restricting the use of asbestos in construction were challenged by Canada, which exports asbestos under WTO. Asian laws that barred the marketing of tobacco products were overturned. The Venezuelan government successfully challenged the U.S. Clean Air Act's provisions, banning the import of dirty gasoline reformulated in refineries in Venezuela. Laws in several European countries restricting the import of lumber cut from old-growth forests or by environmentally destructive clear-cutting were successfully challenged by Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. U.S. laws banning the import of shrimp taken from regions where the shrimp industry is destroying habitats of endangered sea turtles were successfully challenged by several nations and corporations. Corporations can now sue governments, as if they were governments. A California ban on the gasoline additive NTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether, that the EPA had found to be a known animal carcinogen and possible and probable human carcinogen was challenged. MTBE is manufactured by a Canadian corporation, which sued the United States for $750 million. To make up for their loss of profits in California, because the California said that they couldn't sell the products in that state. You think that this is, you know, this is paranoia? No, I don't think so. In 1972, after 25 years of lobbying by the Humane Society of the United States, Congress passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The United States Congress, people elected by you and me, in 1972, passed the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which barred U.S. tuna fishermen from using purse seine nets that killed hundreds of thousands of dolphins every year. Dolphins swim above schools of tuna, so the fishermen look for schools of dolphins, and they know that there's tuna underneath them. And they'd have these nets that are 2 and 3 miles long, and they just sweep the air. They get all the tuna, get all the dolphins, too. Congress banned this in 1972. In 1988... the law was strengthened and allowed for the dolphin-safe label on tuna that was caught without these purse seine nets. In 1995, the first year after ratification of GATT-WTO, pushed through by Bill Clinton, Mexico challenged the United States under the rules of the WTO, claiming that the Marine Mammal Protection Act and subsequent laws passed by we the people here in the United States that strengthened it were illegal violations of free trade. The Clinton administration took Mexico's side in the agreements, or shall we say the multinational corporations, and the WTO prevailed. It is now legal to catch and import into the United States purse seine netted tuna from anywhere in the world. The WTO ruling was a problem for American packagers of imported and domestic tuna, because consumers loved the dolphin-safe labeling. So they lobbied Congress and U.S. regulatory agencies to get rules passed that as long as the fishing corporation certified that, and I quote, no dolphins were observed being killed during a particular catch, tuna could still be labeled dolphin-safe. Although the evidence is clear that dolphin populations have again begun to crash worldwide, oddly, not one fisherman has yet stepped up to notify his employer that their catch should be thrown back into the ocean because he saw a dolphin die, in the same way that everybody admits killed millions of dolphins between 1959 and 1972. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want millions, mister.
Tom Rush.
I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back
my job again.
Tom Rush, one of the great folk singers of our era, one of the great human beings, an old friend. He did a number of benefits for the New England Salem Children's Village, a community for abused kids that Louise and I started 27 years ago in New Hampshire. Still there, still doing well. In fact, a picture of the school, the Hutter School that we started, was in Newsweek last week. But I digress, and I don't want to do a Don Imus about this. I'm just on the board. I don't go there for vacations. Anyhow, and God bless Don. I think he's doing great work. The point that I was to get back to this. Here's this letter that I've got from Michael in Japan. And he said, you know, okay, you're speaking partly about the troubles of free trade agreements create for citizens while enriching multinational corporations. And that's my larger point that I've been making all along is that these agreements benefit GE, they benefit ExxonMobil, they benefit Dow, they benefit Monsanto. They don't benefit the citizens of the countries. And that what we are getting is government not of, by, and for we the people, but government of, by, and for the multinational corporations. And again, I'm not anti-corporate, and I'm not anti-business. I am, however, as Teddy Roosevelt said, he did, very explicitly, I've got a great quote from him in my book, Unequal Protection. He said, I'm paraphrasing now. He said, we have no problem with the small businessman. He's the person who's made America great. We have no problem with the medium-sized businessman. He's the anchor and the pillar of our community. When the big businessman, however, seeks to influence policy in Washington, we have a problem with him. In any case, Michael says, I can't say I understand the concept as it relates to within nations, and was wondering if you could comment on the following in a future broadcast. Specifically, the U.S. is, I suppose, he says, merely a group of states that have agreed to freely trade between themselves. Why is not this group of free trading entities a problem? Don't the agreements between our United States allow companies to find areas of cheapest labor or to skirt undesirable local laws? He said, is it then that free trade theory doesn't work between sovereign entities, but if the sovereign entities merge, it is suddenly beneficial for all? It did seem to work well for the USA. Well, actually, no. This is what you're missing, Michael. From 1935, it wasn't the Hatch Act, the Glass Act? I forget what it was called now. In 1935, a law was passed which allowed unionization and which said if a majority of people in a workplace want a union, you have to have the union. The employer has to have a union if the majority of the employees want to have that. In 1935. And in 1947, and in 1935, when that law was passed, about 6 or 7% of the American workforce was unionized. By 1947, we were up to 35% of the workforce unionized. The beginning of the golden era of the American middle class was really and truly here. Because for every union job with good wages and benefits, there is an identical job, non-union job, because the unions have set the floor and the ceiling for the labor market. And so roughly 70% of Americans could raise their families, put their kids through school, had their medical expenses covered, had a pension, pay for their kids through college, take care of, had a vacation, 70%, and with a single wage earner. And the Republicans in Congress were furious about this, representing the interests of big business in 1947. And so they passed a law called the Taft-Hartley Act that said that individual states could decide to opt out of this 1935 law, which gave states, which said that if the majority of people in the workplace want to be in a union, that they have to have, that you have to have the union. And maybe somebody in our chat room will tell me the name of that 1935 law. It's just gone. In any case, Harry Truman was president at the time. In the election of 1946, the Republicans had taken back the House and Senate. But he was still the president. He was a Democrat. And the Republicans passed this law, and Harry Truman vetoed it. And so they took it back, and they overrode his veto with a two-thirds vote in the House and the Senate, the largely Republican, along with a few conservative Southern Democrats. And the result of this, the upshot of this, was that a number of states in the South said, okay, we are going to exempt ourselves from that 1935 law. And we're going to say that even if the majority of people in a workplace say that they want to have a union, then everybody in the workplace doesn't have to join the union. And this has been euphemistically referred to as the right-to-work laws or the right-to-work states. And thus began the decline, the slow decline, of unionization in the United States. In 1947, 35%, that was the peak. And so what we had then within the United States, and this is what Michael is writing about. And by the way, Ira, line two is ringing, just so you notice it. It doesn't have a ringer on it. This is what we had in the United States, is that you had then states, individual states within the United States, that were essentially doing to the northern states, some of the southern states were doing to the northern states, what China is now doing to the United States. And so you had huge migrations. When Louise and I first moved to Atlanta in 1983, there were 2 million people there. When we left 10 years ago, there were over 3 million people there. A right-to-work state. It drawing all the, you know, now you'd say, hey, that was a great thing for Atlanta, but what did it do to Detroit? Well, at least it was all within the United States. There was a general lowering of the standard of living as a result of this, but it wasn't dramatic because we still had the same housing costs, we still had the same medical care costs, we still had the same transportation costs. Now, when you shift this to another country, though, in China, people can literally work for 30 cents an hour because they can get housing for $5 a month, and they can get medical care. The hospital that I used to work in China in November of 1987, when I spent a month in the International Acupuncture Hospital, training hospital in China, 700-bed hospital, where they taught, I was going through a course learning acupuncture. I was curious, you know, okay. And it was 3 cents. That's what U.S. I mean, it was in the ribimini or whatever, the yuan, the local currency, it was more than that. It was, you know, about a third of a day's salary, but it was the equivalent of 3 cents U.S. to come into the hospital, to spend a day in the hospital. So in those countries, it's very cheap. So, but the point, Michael, is that you have problems within sovereign countries if individual states go into competition with each other, just like you have between nations in answer to that. And which finally, you know, brings us back to now you know why Brian Williams, the new star of the NBC Evening News, who replaced Tom Brokaw, why Brian Williams says that his responsibility, that he has a responsibility to listen to Rush Limbaugh. And, of course, some of us would say to be a proponent of those same policies. Brian Williams here, in fact, our piggy alert for the day.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dead. Always have clean shirts.
Oh, they always have clean shirts. This is from the Wall Street Journal this week. Dateline New Delhi, an article, the headline, in India's outsourcing boom, General Electric played a starring role. General Electric, of course, being the company that owns NBC, which has employed Brian Williams. In September 1989, Jack Welch. Now, Jack, you'll recall, Jack has been raised to iconic status. He made billions for General Electric. We should all aspire to be like Jack Welch, right? I mean, the Jack Welch aura, the books about him, and, you know, blah de blah de blah de blah. Well, here's how it happened. In September of 1989, Jack Welch, then General Electric Company's chairman, flew to India for a sales call. Now, he was over there, he was trying to sell products to the Indians, the people of India, the companies of India, the government of India. But, notes the Wall Street Journal, it was Mr. Welch who got pitched. This guy came to him, Sam Petrodi, the chief technology advisor to the late Indian Premier Rajiv Gandhi, comes to him and says, basically, hey, We've got a bunch of good, you know, English-speaking people here. Why don't you move some of your high-tech work over to India? Jack Welch says in reply, if I kiss your cheek, what do I get in return? And notes the Wall Street Journal, 15 years later, the answer is clear. The global outsourcing revolution. India today earns more than $17 billion from corporations worldwide seeking low-cost overseas talent to do everything from writing software to collect debts to design semiconductors. GE, in large measure, stoked the phenomenon, playing an unheralded role as the Johnny Appleseed of India Inc. and reaping billions in savings for itself along the way. Now you know how Jack Welch made himself and General Electric rich. Isn't it odd that he's being held up as this is the guy that everybody in corporate America should emulate? Now, the Wall Street Journal notes, publicly, General Electric has been reluctant to take credit for its singular role. They go on to note, however, but the strategy has been pivotal for GE. In 2000, it inaugurated a Jack F. Welch Technology Center in Bangalore that employs thousands of researchers working on everything from new refrigerators to jet airlines. Helped by the outsourcing boom, India's economy is on track to grow 7% for the fiscal year ending this month. They go on to note Indian businessmen and politicians widely credit Mr. Welch and GE for seeding their country's economic boom. They point out a software programmer with 4 years, 2 to 4 years experience. In the United States, you'd have to pay that person $62,000 a year. In India, $10,000 a year. As the Wall Street Journal notes, GE contracts helped underwrite the growth of India's technology sector. They go on to say other companies such as American Express and British Airways had already moved some of their back office operations to India, but it was Mr. Welch's enthusiastic support. Or with Mr. Welch's enthusiastic support, GE eventually went much further, shifting thousands of jobs and untold dollars in operational expenses to India. Savings on backroom operations alone amount to about $300 million every single year. The venture offered clear economic advantages, notes the Wall Street Journal. An Indian call center worker earns around $3,000 a year, compared with more than $27,000 in the U.S. After the call center's first trial in early 93, GE allocated more than $10 million to expand the operations. And so it goes. And now what's the result of this? The result of this is that we have gone from before Ronald Reagan became president, we were the richest nation in the world, and more countries and more people around the world owed the United States money, had borrowed money from us, than any other nation in the world. We were the nation's bank. We were the nation's lender. We were the world's largest creditor. More people owed us money than anyone else. Today, we are the nation's we are the world's debtor. We are the largest debtor in the world. We are the most broke nation in the world. This, of course, was Ronald Reagan's strategy, the Grover Norquist strategy, the star of the beast, run up huge deficits and then say, oh, look at this, the deficit is so bad, we can't afford these social programs anymore because they don't like what they call socialism, what the rest of us would call things like the social safety net, like Social Security, for example, or Medicare. You think the hysteria around Social Security is bad right now? Wait a couple of years. If Social Security is supposed to go into the red in 2042, Medicare is going to go into the red in 10 years. Nobody's talking about that yet. That's next. The bottom line, Americans are getting poorer and poorer. With the singular exception of the Jack Welches in the United States, those who are the heads of the multinational corporations that are siphoning the money out that is being made on the backs of the American middle class. And then, as the Wall Street Journal noted in their Sunday edition last week, an article by Craig Carman, with the U.S. dollar mired in a prolonged bear market, some small investors are seeking a way to bet directly it'll continue to decline. EverBank World Markets, this is EverBank.com, one of the few places you can go. You can actually open an account there in foreign currencies. Warren Buffett has done it, not through EverBank, but he has said he's no longer in the dollar. He is out of the dollar. Bill Gates is doing it. The wealthy are bailing out of America. You could say their businesses already have. Whatever happened. Oh, it was called the Wagner Act, by the way. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ira. I appreciate that. Marion in Nevada on the line. Hey, Marion, thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I know you're probably sick of hearing about Terri Schiavo, but I keep wondering why all these politicians are interested in the case. And what I'm seeing is something that they're trying to be all really nice and goody-goody here will save a life. But what I see is that it's a hair's breadth from them saying when and when we cannot have our lives saved if any kind of insurance is going to be used to save it.
Yeah, well there's two reasons why, Marion, that they're promoting this. Number one, it's a distraction so that people aren't talking about the things I was just talking about. And number two, because they're setting it up for the Supreme Court battle. They want to say, look at these judges. They don't care about life. This is the rationale for putting extreme right-wingers on the court who will then support the right to life.
And then, I'm seeing them as having the right to death.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it goes beyond that. Marion, we're out of time, but yes, good point. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I think the answer is self-evident. 4 to 5.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tanks, or the RNC, or for that matter, the DNC. Welcome back to our program. Talking about economic slavery, Franklin Roosevelt quoted an ancient British judge in his 1936 acceptance speech in Philadelphia. Acceptance of his party's nomination for second term as president of the United States. And he said, an ancient British judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. You're not hungry. You're not free if you're hungry. You're not free if you're homeless. That there has to be a certain level of economic security in order for there to be political freedom. Now, the conservatives among us are going full tilt boogie, and they're getting quite open about it in saying, that's it, Roosevelt's dead, get over it, and we're going to take apart his programs. We're going to take apart Medicare. We're going to take apart Social Security. We're going to, forget about the social safety net. We're doing something about that. Well, here, in their own words. Hang on just a second. The magic button.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yes, we are doing something about that. So what did Roosevelt have to say about this? This from his 1936 speech. He was talking about how the largest corporations in America had risen up and tried to take political power. And he referred to them as the economic royalists.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And then he had something to say about their power.
Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. 1-866-889-8894. Oh, line dropped. Yeah. This is the core issue. I'm telling you, this is the core issue of our day, of our time. When Roosevelt, I just want to wrap up with just this one final thought from Franklin Roosevelt.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
And they still are. They still are.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
There you go. Man, it's just very, very straightforward. It is time for us to stand up and say, we want our country back. We're going to take our country back. We're going to do it in the ballot box. We're going to do it by organizing. We're going to do it by getting active. We're going to do it by waking people up to the history of this great nation. Our program produced this week by Louise. Line production, Ira Gravatt. Thank you so much, Ira. Rama, thanks for coming in Monday and running the board. Brad, our music, Shelby, for streaming us around the planet. And Ben Birch at White Rose Society as well, Shelby at radiopower.org, the folks at American FM. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Jay for our music, the folks in our chat room for showing up, and thanks to you for listening. We'll see you next week, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.